Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up a little later in the show, Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum learns more about the University of Louisville Grawemeyer Award for Music Composition and this year's winner. First, the Louisville-based organization Healing Place is teaming up with a national effort called Faces and Voices of Recovery to launch an educational effort in advance of an HBO special on addiction. National Field Director of Faces and Voices of Recovery Tom Coderre was in Louisville this week to help bring together community leaders and talk about ways to improve recovery efforts locally. Coderre, a former Rhode Island state senator who has dealt with addiction himself, spoke with WFPL's Julie Goodwin about his efforts.
Tom, explain how you got involved in the recovery movement.
Well, I'm a person in long-term recovery, which means I haven't used any drugs or alcohol in almost 4 years now. The way I got involved was through treatment. I was arrested one day for a possession of a controlled substance in my home city, and I was offered a pretrial diversion program to treatment, and I took advantage of that, and I went to treatment. I was in treatment for 5.5 months, and that's how I found long-term recovery.
And you served in the Rhode Island State Senate from 1995 until 2003. Were you dealing with addiction at that time?
I was dealing with addiction from, for the better part of, 10 or 12 years.
How did you ultimately make the decision to get help?
I had sought help on several occasions, and, it never seemed to stick, I knew I had a problem with addiction almost from, the instant I started using. Pathway to recovery, though, sometimes involves, stumbling a few times before you start to crawl and before you start to walk and then start to run. So there's a process there, and I was able to, again find recovery through going to a treatment program. And what treatment is treatment gives you the tools you need to find long-term recovery.
If you would describe the recovery process that you went through.
Sure. Well, recovery for me means, number one, that I'm no longer using drugs. So I had to stop using drugs first. Once I stopped using, then I had to really take a look at my life and make some decisions. Through my addiction, I had lost everything. I was a member of the Rhode Island State Senate for 8 years. I was the executive director of a nonprofit agency in Providence, Rhode Island. And addiction really robbed me of those things. It also robbed me of my relationships, in my life, the relationships with my family, relationships with my friends. And so the recovery process for me was about getting those things back. Part of recovery is regaining the things. So it's recovering the things that you've lost in your life.
So what was different about that final recovery process that you went through that was different than the ones previous?
I really don't know why it was successful, but what I can tell you is that I can tell you that, hitting bottom is part of my story. And, getting arrested in your home city when you're a former public official and the shame and embarrassment that goes along with that was part of hitting bottom for me. And I think that was a wake-up call for me. And, I had never been arrested before. I had never had a criminal charge before. And actually being put in a jail cell and having some time to think about it, that was a turning point for me. During that time, the obsession to use was lifted from me for some reason. And, I think some of this is an act of God. Some of it's, people praying for you and being prayed up into long-term recovery. Some of it's unexplainable, But what I think is the most important part about it is that the obsession to use was lifted from me. And then I had a choice to make. I could either surrender to my disease, or I could make a choice to go back to using. And I was finished using. I didn't want to use anymore. Using had really beaten me up badly. I was a badly broken human being when I arrived in recovery, when I arrived into treatment. And long-term recovery has helped me become a productive member of society again. Has helped me regain my self-confidence back. It's helped me in so many different ways, I'm just really grateful to have found long-term recovery.
And obviously that's what places like the Louisville-based Healing Place are trying to do, and fairly successfully.
Absolutely. The Healing Place and Angel Programs are two fantastic programs here in Louisville, where people can come for either no cost or very little cost and get their lives back on track. It's an amazing, amazing program here.
So what are you trying to do now through Faces and Voices of Recovery?
Faces and Voices of Recovery is a national campaign. It's based out of Washington, D.C., and it's a campaign of people in recovery, people in long-term recovery, which means people who haven't used drugs or alcohol in a number of years, their family members, their friends, and allies. And what we do is we speak with one voice. Number one, we want to see addiction be viewed as a public health crisis. And number two, we want to see changes enacted in law to end the discriminatory barriers that people have to getting into long-term recovery. In addition to that, one of our goals is to speak out with one voice so that we put a face and a voice on recovery so we can, you know, end stigma and discrimination around people who have addiction disorders.
What are some of those barriers that people face in getting into long-term recovery?
Well, one of the largest barriers that people face is that we have a health insurance system which doesn't pay for people to get the treatment that they need. People are oftentimes discriminated against because of their addiction. Addiction does not get viewed as other public health crises. You know, if I had a heart attack and I went to the emergency room, they would treat me for my heart attack. If I had an addiction problem and I relapse, I can go to an emergency room and I can be denied services. I can be denied services from my insurance company to get into treatment. And treatment works. We know that. We know that people who go to treatment find long-term recovery. And if those opportunities aren't made available for people through their health insurance companies, people end up continuing to not be able to get into long-term recovery. They keep failing. And we need to really correct that. We need to have a system that looks at people with addiction disorders and looks at addiction just like any other public health crisis and provides the coverage that they need so they can get the treatment that they need so they can get better.
Explain what your organization, Faces and Voices of Recovery, is hoping to accomplish concerning the HBO special.
Well, there's been this tremendous documentary that HBO has produced over the past couple of years about addiction. It's a 90-minute documentary. It's going to air on HBO on March 15th. And what our organization is doing with our partners around the country is we're promoting the show so that folks out there in our communities around the country can have a better understanding of what addiction is, that it's a treatable brain disease, and that people that people who have addiction disorders can find long-term recovery. We have a program called Addiction and Recovery Communities Take Action, and what we're trying to do is raise the awareness, raise the profile of this issue in the minds of the public and of policymakers and politicians so that they can rise up and respond to this issue as a community. The community can take action and say that we're not going to take it anymore. These people who are out there with addiction disorders need to get the help that they need in order to get better, and we're going to make sure that, you know, insurance companies are held accountable, that government's held accountable, and that the community's held accountable to make sure that this problem gets solved.
And Tom, one of your concerns about this HBO special is that it does not address the issue of recovery. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if it's certainly one of the things that we're involved with this as a result of. HBO has been tremendous in terms of bringing us into the fold and bringing us part of this process so that we can talk about the other side of the issue. Because, you know, in a 90-minute documentary, 90 minutes is not a lot of time to talk about this very complicated issue. One of the things that we want to make sure that people know is that there are millions of Americans who have found long-term recovery. That, you know, addiction is not the plague. It's not something that you can't get better from. Millions of Americans have found long-term recovery. And our job, really, we feel, is to show the other side, to show that if the problem is addiction, the solution is long-term recovery. And we want to highlight in communities all across America, the faces, the many faces and the many voices of recovery who exist out there today. You know, I think one of the things that happens is that when people find long-term recovery, you know, they get their lives back. You know, and they start to they reintegrate themselves into society, and you no longer see them as the person with the addiction, the stereotypical bum on the street with a bag of belongings in one hand and a bottle of booze in the other. That sometimes is the image that people conjure up in their minds when they think about addiction. They don't necessarily think of the millions of Americans who have jobs, who have families, who have kids to take care of every day, who, you know, are the coaches of little league teams and who are productive members of society, going to work every day, paying their taxes. You know, this is really what we're a campaign about. We're a campaign about showcasing the faces and voices of recovery so that people see, you know, that one in four of Americans have been affected by addiction. One in four Americans, which means when you're in a room, just look around the room, one in four of the people that are in that room have had trouble with addiction. So, you know, this is a campaign to really showcase that a lot of people are not trapped in the cycle of addiction anymore. A lot of people have found long-term recovery, and that's in that it's possible, so that we can change kind of the stigma, the public attitudes around addiction. And, you know, it's only by changing that, you know, reducing stigma and changing those attitudes that we're going to be able to have effective changes in public policy. Because until we get people to look at this issue as a human issue, as something that affects, you know, their family members, affects their neighbors, affects their coworkers, the person maybe that's sitting in the next cubicle from them, until we get people to look at it that way, we're not going to see the changes that we need to see in terms of public policy, in terms of holding insurance companies accountable to make sure that they treat this disease and give people the coverage that they need so they can get the help they need.
Tom, thank you for talking with me today.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for taking the time to do this interview.
More information on Tom Coderre, The Healing Place, and the HBO special is available at our website. Go to WFPL.org. There are some new babies at the Louisville Zoo. Three maned wolf pups were born in January. Maned wolves are endangered, and there are only about 100 in zoos in the U.S. WFPL's Heidi Caravan spoke with curator Steve Wing about the new pups.
Steve, tell me, what are maned wolf pups?
Well, it's the offspring of a species of South American canid. It's called the maned wolf. It looks like a giant red fox on stilts.
And that's mane, M-A-N-E, M-A-N-E-D, maned wolf pups.
Right, right. If you look at them, they don't have a mane like a lion does, but they have this big ruff on their shoulders, and it kind of goes down their back a little ways.
What, describe their color and what else do they look like?
Well, it is a very beautiful reddish russet type color with, you know, black socks. They do really look like gigantic red foxes. You know, a red fox running around town here might weigh, 5-8 pounds, whatever. Maned wolf is about 50 or 60 pounds.
The parents are 9 and 11 years old, Savannah and Zev. Am I pronouncing that properly, Zev?
Yeah.
And this is the second litter for them. Is that uncommon?
No, it's not uncommon at all. Maned wolves are, within accredited zoos, are managed by an SSP program, that Species Survival Program. And a bunch of maned wolf experts will get into a room and they'll sit down at a computer and decide who should be breeding with who. And because we need to keep our genetics viable in our population, and we can't overcrowd what we have, well, the resources that we have in zoos. So in 2003, they recommended that we breed this pair, and then again last year they recommended that we breed them, and we were successful again.
Now, maned wolves are endangered. Why is that?
Well, I believe it's mostly loss of habitat for the maned wolf. You know, the main causes of most animals going endangered in the wild are traced back to humans. You know, it's habitat loss, or it's deforestation, or cutting down the trees and plowing up the land to grow crops and things like that. So I think with maned wolves, that also holds true.
Where are they usually found? Where are they native to?
They are native to the pampas of southern South America. You know, like Argentina, that area?
You had one of the pups born one day and then two the next day. Is that a common thing or is that unusual?
It is quite unusual, and we don't really know why that happened, but it has happened in other species. This is the first time we've heard of it happening in maned wolves. That doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, but that's one of the things that we learned from our guys that we have here at the zoo is what is normal for them. So, but it was a little bit unusual, and but all three pups are doing well and they're healthy, and mom's taking care of them. So we're assuming it's within normal limits.
Three pups to a litter, is that common?
2 to 3 pups is very common for a maned wolf. They'll occasionally have only one, or sometimes they'll have as many as 4. But 2 or 3 is usually the average.
Do you have does the zoo have the pups from the previous litter in 2003?
No, those pups grew up, and those experts got together with their computer, and they recommended that they go to other zoos. And the male pup went to the zoo in Springfield, Missouri. And the female, I take that back, he went to the zoo in Little Rock, Arkansas, and the female went to Springfield, Missouri.
What will happen to these three new pups?
Well, there again, those experts will get together with their computer, and then they will decide what the best pairings would be for them and at what location. So we may send one off and then keep two for a while, or it could be any combination, but we won't know that yet for probably at least 6 months.
I'm assuming they'd want to the pups would want to be with their mother for a while. How long will that be before there's a decision made to move them elsewhere?
Well, it's individualistic. Savannah got along well with her daughter for the first 2 years until we needed to move them out. And that's probably typical of what happens down in South America in the wild. The mothers teach the sons and daughters how to be maned wolves. Some of it's instinctive, but some of it is learned from the mother. And then usually after about a year and a half or 2 years, I think that the mother kind of chases them away so they establish their own territories.
Now, they're off exhibit because of the cold weather, the darned cold weather preventing us from seeing these wolf pups. When do you think visitors to the zoo could see them?
Well, you know, even if this was warm weather, the wolf pups would be off exhibit because they're kind of like our pet dogs and stuff, too, where they're not very, they're actually pretty helpless for the first couple of months. So I'm guessing maybe around the beginning of March. It should be coming up actually pretty soon. They're starting to motor around pretty good, and if the weather warms up, we may be able to let them out.
How has the birth of these pups, how is that going to be used in zoo educational programs?
Well, we are able to use any of the animals that are born here to, with our educational classes. How birth and death and the circle of life, that type of stuff. But I think one of the main educational components, at least, is people will come out and hopefully learn more about the animals while they're here watching the babies or watching any of the other animals that we have here.
I understand there's a bulletin being prepared that will be translated into different languages and sent to other countries as well?
That's actually already been done. Marcel Giannoloni with our education department produced that a couple of years ago, and that is being used in other parts of the world.
Tell us about the naming contest.
Well, I don't have very much information on that yet. I do know that there is going to be a naming contest. And I believe it's going to be at least partially web-based, but that's a different department at the zoo, and they haven't told me exactly how they're going to run that yet.
So the website is louisvillezoo.org, so we should be able to find out some information there. Any word on the last time we talked about the baby pygmy hippo.
Right.
Any word on some sort of naming contest for the baby pygmy hippo?
I think they're going to try and combine these together. I think that was the last word that I heard. But yes, we definitely want to have some sort of naming opportunity for both these species.
And going back to the pygmy hippo and the cold weather, will we be able to see them around the same time, do you think?
I'm thinking, yeah, this cold weather just can't last forever, and once it does start warming up, we're going to try and get them outside into the fresh air and the sun as soon as possible.
Steve Wayne, curator for the Louisville Zoo, thanks so much for talking with me today.
You're very welcome.
That was Louisville Zoo curator Steve Wing. He spoke with WFPL's Heidi Caravan about a new litter of rare maned wolf pups born at the zoo. When we come back, Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum previews an upcoming concert featuring this year's Grawemeyer Award winner for music composition. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, WFPL's Robin Fisher talks with Carolyn Smards Frost. Her new book is called I've Got a Home in Glory Land, a lost tale of the Underground Railroad. First, the University of Louisville School of Music will present a concert of Grawemeyer Award-winning composers tonight at Comstock Concert Hall. Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum recently talked with Professors Fred Speck and Paul York about the program, a cello concerto with Carol Husa, and the events in New York City coming up this week.
Tell us about the Carol Husa Commission.
Well, we'll be premiering a terrific new work called Cheetah, and the development of this project has taken place over a number of years. We originally had hoped to commission Carol, and in fact had a smaller picture in mind that it might be a piece for the New Music Ensemble back in 1998. But as the idea developed, Carol really wished to write, and this thrilled me, a larger work for our wind symphony.
Now, Carol Husa has always had a close relationship with U of L, and reading back over the years some of the composition master classes and that sort of thing. That's a unique relationship with one of the Grawemeyer winners in that he's always had a close relationship, it seems, with Louisville.
Well, that's true. There's a great sense of fellowship that we all have with Carol. In fact, a number of years ago, he wrote a separate commission, the Trojan Women, the ballet, for the dedication of the new School of Music building. And he had, in addition, a relationship with the Louisville Orchestra, of course, and has recorded on some of the first edition recordings, and has spent time on a number of occasions with our faculty and with our students. We've had him twice in recent years as the principal guest composer at our annual New Music Festival. And so we've all grown to really cherish the relationship that we have with him as musicians and just as having a friend who's a terrific human being.
And how does he work with other students? How is he as a teacher?
Well, during the time that I've been directing the Wind Symphony, there have been two occasions on which Carol's visited the campus and we've performed his works. And he's been there in advance, of course, and supervised rehearsals and done some interaction with the students. And he's very passionate, very insightful, and makes a wonderful connection with the students. They're always invigorated by his presence, and his simple presence sort of increases their energy toward peak performance, and they feel as though they're better musicians as a result of their experience with him each and every time.
How did the idea of a commission come about at the University of Louisville? Was it an idea specifically for the Grawemeyer Award?
Well, I spoke with colleagues on the theory composition faculty regarding the idea of a new commission from Carol Husa, and they were interested in that topic. Again, this has been several years ago, and so the support was developed for that commission through the area, the Division of Music Theory and Composition. And we're thrilled at this stage that now we have this piece in its timing. You know, sometimes you can't second guess why timing is as it is, but in the way that things have worked out, we'll be doing this piece, of course, in Carnegie Hall as the world premiere. And then this summer, that same group has been invited to perform at the World Association for Symphonic Bands and Ensembles, a huge international conference in Killarney, Ireland. And so we'll have the opportunity to perform the Husa work for that international audience as well.
Now, the other works on the program include works by Joan Tower, Penderecki, Takemitsu, and John Corigliano. Maybe give us a thumbnail sketch of each of these works and how they fit into the program.
Well, the Joan Tower piece is a riveting and an electric work. As you might grasp from the title, when you read Fascinating Ribbons, you think, oh, is there perhaps a Gershwin connection? And there is a little rhythmic Gershwin connection that is heard in the work, and Joan takes from that kernel of a rhythmic idea her take, her way of developing the materials in a vibrant and exciting way that makes this piece work well to open our portion of the concert, because it has a real bold, robust, rhythmic overture character to it.
What can we expect from the Penderecki and Takemitsu pieces?
It has also a rather a rhythmic, muscular character that is represented well by brass and timpani, but also a lyric middle section which features solo passages, beautiful, quiet solo passages by the horn and also by solo trumpet that creates a beautiful sense of architecture within this rather concise piece. We pair that then with the Takemitsu Day Signal, which is from what were a set of two pieces that Takemitsu did, although he wrote them at different times and for different occasions, and titled them Signals from Heaven, and this is Day Signal. And it has a gorgeous lyric modal character to it, and the harmonies that develop from overlapping lines within this beautiful modal setting. So they pair together very beautifully.
Tell us about the Tarantella movement from the Symphony No. 1 of John Corigliano.
John had earlier on written a piano work that had Tarantella in it, a set of pieces called Gazebo Dances, and these pieces were dedicated to a friend and also written so that friends could play them. Mm-hmm. It takes us back to the notion of musicianly friends gathering and in a little salon setting, making music together for the joy of it. Well, those pieces, those piano pieces, were then scored by John for concert band as Gazebo Dances for concert band. So they took on a new life, and there's the Tarantella melody, of course, in that setting, rescored once again for orchestra from the Gazebo Dances, and then in this symphony, that Tarantella movement becomes the foundation for John, in musical terms, to examine the strife, the anxiety, the rage, despair, and remembrance and tenderness associated with a friend of his who suffered an AIDS-related dementia, although this particular person prior to that was thought of as somebody who had one of the most keen minds in all of the music industry. So it's heartrending, and it's also it's excruciating as well in a fabulous artistic way.
Now, you will be performing a concerto by Carol Husa, a Grawemeyer winner, and with the University of Louisville Symphony Orchestra. Tell us a little bit about Carol Husa as the composer, and maybe a little bit about the cello concerto.
Carol Husa is a Czechoslovakian composer and has written a tremendous amount of works. However, this is his only cello concerto. And It was written at the request of a couple of donors to the University of Southern California, and they commissioned the piece because their brother was a cellist, an amateur cellist, and so they asked Mr. Husa to write this concerto, and then Lynn Harrell is the cellist that premiered it with the USC Symphony Orchestra, with Daniel Lewis conducting. I'm familiar with that because I went to school at USC, and Daniel Lewis was conductor of the orchestra that I played in school. However, this happened in 89, and after I had left. And it was performed in Kennedy Center as well. So it's a five-movement work. Each of the movements is really quite striking and unique, and yet one does have the sense that all the movements go together mm-hmm. very nicely.
Now, you've had an opportunity, I assume, to work with Carol Husa. What was that like? Did he provide a lot of insight, or tell us about your experiences with him?
Well, it was absolutely wonderful. I was allowed to come to his home and spend the evening with him. We went out to dinner, and then about 8:30 at night, I started playing the piece for him in his living room, and we were up until 1 o'clock that morning, talking about the piece, talking about music, talking about everything. It was really an inspiring experience, and he's just really an amazing human being, really inspiring kind of musician, really a pleasure to get to know and to talk to. So he took me through, I played each movement, and he told me a lot about what was going on when he wrote the piece, what he was thinking about, what he was trying to say. And then, you know, I got up the next morning, had breakfast with him, and then we sat there and talked about the piece for about 2 hours. And I wasn't playing anymore, but I took notes while he described again all little things about the piece. So it was very enlightening to me. It gave me much more insight into the piece, and I think I have a greater understanding. And I'm just so fortunate and really so thankful that I had this opportunity to spend time with him.
Well, I think that was my next question was going to be how has meeting him and talking with him changed your perspective on the piece? Because I assume you learned this piece before you knew him personally.
Yes. Well, it really always helps me if I have an idea of what the composer was thinking about, what was going on in their life, or anything that relates to the piece. Because sometimes you talk to a composer and they don't really want to tell you anything about that. This, mm-hmm. Here's the piece and play it. But it made me really understand a lot of his musical language. Which, you know, happens with modern music sometimes. It's a little confusing if you're not familiar with the language. Mm-hmm. But I had greater insight into his language, and also what he was trying to say through the piece and what he wants to communicate, because that's very important to him, that the intensity and very elegiac moments of this piece is really put across to the audience.
That was Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum talking with Professors Paul York and Fred Speck of the University of Louisville School of Music about the Carnegie Hall Preview Concert. It takes place tonight at 7:30 in Comstock Concert Hall. The program will feature music by Grawemeyer-winning composers, including the Cello Concerto by Carol Husa. More information is available at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. When we come back, WFPL's Robin Fisher interviews Carolyn Smards Frost about her archaeological dig in Toronto and the book about the excavation. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. In 1985, Carolyn Smards Frost began a journey she calls her passion. As the director of an archaeological dig in Toronto, she oversaw the excavation of Thornton and Lucy Blackburn's house. In 1831, the Blackburns were Kentucky slaves who escaped via the Underground Railroad. For two people who simply wanted to be free and together, they changed history from Michigan to Toronto. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with Smards Frost about her new book, I've Got a Home in Glory Land, A Lost Tale of the Underground Railroad.
Can you just set the stage for us with the book?
The storyline came about because in 1985 I was looking for an archaeological site in downtown Toronto on which to run a program for school children. and stumbled across the home, what had been the home of a man that the Toronto Street Directories called Thornton Blackburn Cabman Colored in 1846. Research revealed that he had been born in Maysville, Kentucky, but eventually the trail of the clues led me to Louisville because he and his wife had actually escaped from Louisville, Kentucky. He'd been taken to Louisville as a young man. And they had fled on the day before Independence Day, 1831, on a steamboat in broad daylight, dressed in their finest clothes, and bearing forged free papers. And they fled as far as Cincinnati on the steamboat, the Versailles, and then made their way to Detroit, Michigan. And they were there for 2 years, when one of the men for whom Thornton had worked at Wirtz and Reinhardt's store at the corner of 4th and Main in Louisville, where there's a plaque to Thornton Blackburn, Thornton and Lucy, he was recognized on the street and captured, and the Blackburns were going to be sent back to Kentucky and to slavery when the black community of Detroit rioted and rescued them.
You make an interesting comment in the introduction, and I might not get it exactly right, but you talk about the collective consciousness, sort of the history of the Underground Railroad, and how we tend to think of it as a bunch of daring and concerned white folks, and we sort of overlook the African-American role in the Underground Railroad.
Oh, absolutely true. I mean, not only were the majority of the people who assisted fugitive slaves on their routes north free black families and communities on the way, but also the people who I believe very strongly are the heroes of the Underground Railroad are the people who ran. I mean, after all, the Underground Railroad was a reaction to an existing state of affairs. It was a reaction to the fact there were a lot of people trying to escape from slavery.
When was the term first used, Underground Railroad?
About 1831, because railroads didn't exist much till then, right?
Well, that's very true.
Yeah, it was the latest technological term of the age, and that's how it got adopted, much as we use computer language all the time.
In the opening scenes of the book, or the opening scene of the book, you show Thornton and Ruthie at the time looking essentially like relaxed and just ordinary individuals down by the river.
Yes.
And that was an incredible... That was an incredible visual for me because I guess from television and from the movies, I'm used to seeing the runaway slave in the ragged clothes crawling through the field, and I guess that is a movie convention.
Well, that certainly existed. There were certainly lots of people who escaped from plantations, but also there were a tremendous number of people who didn't live on plantations, particularly in Kentucky. Smaller farms were much more the order of the day, but also... The work of the cities was done by slaves. The building of buildings, the digging of canals, the road work was done by enslaved African Americans. And so a great many people were not plantation farm workers, which is the idea we have in our head whenever we think of the Underground Railroad.
In the beginning of the book, Lucy Blackburn is referred to as Ruthie, and you do give an interesting explanation of names. And I wondered if you could give us just a brief history of that.
Well, she was named Ruthie in slavery, at least in her last years in slavery, which was in Louisville, Kentucky, when she worked for George and Charlotte Backus. And the Backuses had a dry goods and import-export business, basically a wholesaling business in Louisville. But she may have had a different name before she came into their hands, I believe, because they came from Connecticut and had taken the water route by boat around Florida and up to New Orleans and then come up the Mississippi River. I believe that she was purchased in New Orleans. So she may have had the name Lucy before she got there, but people did rename their slaves if they didn't like their names. That's one of the dehumanizing things about slavery. But the other thing that is a possibility, too, is she simply liked the name Lucy and preferred to be called Lucy in freedom because she was never called Ruthie again in any documentation or discussion of her after she reached Canada. She left that name behind.
So Thornton and Lucy make their way to Michigan, as you had mentioned earlier, and live there for 2 years, and then they're caught.
They were caught.
Tell us about the slave catcher business.
Well, this was really interesting. There were professional bounty hunters, professional slave catchers, who lived off the proceeds of catching slaves and taking them back to their erstwhile owners for rewards. But the people who came after Thornton and his wife were not professional slave catchers. In fact, one of them was a city councilor for Louisville who was an attorney by the name of Benjamin Weir. And he had been engaged by Mrs. Blackburn and Mr. Blackburn were owned by two different people. And so those two groups hired Benjamin Weir and then sent John Pope Oldham's son along, the nephew of Thornton's real owner. Thornton's owner was a widowed woman by the name of Susan Talbot Brown. And Susan Brown's sister was married to John Pope Oldham. And because she was a woman, the estate was managed by a man in those days. And John Pope Oldham, who was a judge in Louisville and the postmaster for Louisville, managed the estate. He sent his son, Talbot Oldham, up to Detroit, along with Benjamin Weir, to claim Thornton, because Talbot had grown up with Thornton to some extent. For 4 or 5 years, they had been youths together, and he could identify him in person.
So they are whisked away essentially to Canada, but there are what's known as the Blackburn Riots.
Oh, this actually was in Detroit. The Blackburn Riots took place, and they are the first racial riots in the city of Detroit, the Blackburn Riots of 1833. And they came about because African-American Detroit refused to see the Blackburns return to slavery. In fact, what they did was they planned the event. It was a carefully choreographed riot. First of all, after the Blackburns had been tried in court and were jailed, they were going to be held for 3 days till a steamboat could take them away back to Kentucky. The community met, and along with the black community was the city attorney, Alexander Frazier, who had tried to defend the Blackburns in court, and his friend, who was the editor of the Detroit Courier, a man by the name of Charles Cleland. So there was white involvement in this as well. And what they planned was that they would rescue Mrs. Blackburn first. Two of the ladies on the Sunday morning, this was June 16th and 17th, 1833, two of the ladies went to the jail and asked if they could go in and pray with Mrs. Blackburn to comfort her before she was to be taken away the next day. And they waited till nightfall and went away weeping into their handkerchiefs with veils covering their faces. And I guess the jailer was pretty dumb because he didn't realize till the next morning that Lucy Blackburn had gone away in one of her friend's clothes, and Mrs. George French, one of the ladies who'd come to the jail, was sitting in Lucy's cell wearing her clothes. So Mrs. Blackburn had already been gotten across the river to Canada. Later that same day, which was Monday, Thornton was brought to the door of the jail, and he was chained. The Talbot Oldham and Benjamin Weir were pretty seriously annoyed, and they were going to have to explain this all to John Pope Oldham and to Mrs. Blackburn's owner, Virgil McKnight, when they got home. So they were taking no chances, and they were going to take him to a cart to take him down the steamboat. When up the main street of Detroit marched a crowd of 200 people. Now, there were not 200 African-Americans in Detroit who lived in Detroit at the time, but people had been coming in from all the rural districts around Detroit as they learned the news that the Blackburns had been taken. In fact, Canadian blacks came across the river as well, people from Canada, from the Amherstburg area, came across by ferry armed to the teeth. And this crowd of 200 people attacked the sheriff, grabbed Thornton, threw him into a cart, took him off in a wild ride to the river, and got him across to Canada. And that was the Blackburn Riots of 1833.
Now, all the Blackburns wanted to do was be free, but here they've escaped. They think they are safe in Detroit, and then they start riots, and then they end up in Canada, and what becomes essentially an international incident that helped shape the U.S. and Canadian policy.
I had been looking for the home of some ordinary people so I could work with school children on it, and I found these extraordinary people, courageous and interesting, and people whose lives literally changed history, and the choices they made did. Because once they reached Canada, what they did was they put the Lieutenant Governor, Sir John Colborne, on the spot. He had just passed the Fugitive Offenders Act, which was a mutual extradition act to allow for extradition of genuine criminals back to the United States and vice versa. And this was the first tough case. The governor of Michigan was no fool, a very interesting man, Stephen Thompson Mason. And what he did was he accused the Blackburns of a crime rather than asking for them as fugitive slaves, because he knew, of course, that since there was no slavery in Canada by that point, there had been, but it wasn't by that point, there was no way they would be returned as fugitive slaves. So he accused them of inciting the riot that rescued Thornton and of trying to kill the sheriff. And Sir John Colborne had absolutely no intention of sending them back, of course, but he had to find grounds on which not to do so under his own, in the terms of his own act. So what he did was he examined the facts of the case and had his attorney general cook up a legal decision. Interestingly, the city attorney from Detroit and the publisher of that newspaper, as I told you, came across the river to offer legal advice to help the Upper Canadian government refute the American request.
Interesting.
Yeah, it got very complicated, but in the end, Colborne refused the request, two extradition demands, and the grounds on which he did so was that they couldn't possibly have committed the crime of which they were accused, because Thornton was inside the jail and Mrs. Blackburn was already in Canada when the riot occurred, and neither one of them had tried to kill the sheriff, obviously. But he also decided that he couldn't send them back, because the punishment for the crime of which they were accused, if they were judged guilty in an American court, or even if they were judged innocent, would be more stringent than Canadian law would allow. And that was that they would be given slavery for life as a sentence. Canadian public policy, refugee law, still uses the same principle. And this was the first development of public policy relating to refugee reception in Canadian history.
Well, I was going to say it's a precursor to the situation now where a criminal or someone will not be extradited if their penalty is death penalty.
Exactly.
So it's really fascinating, I think, how just two people who never set out to change history really did, and they even changed history once they got to Canada, because it's as you say in your book. They started the first taxicab business?
I think that as long as Thornton and his wife were working for white people, to be frank, they were reminded of not being independent. They were reminded of slavery. And within 2 short years of arriving in Toronto, which was, they came in 1834, and by 1836 they were cooking up a private business of their own. Thornton had been working as a waiter at the law courts, the Benchers dining room. And maybe there he overheard people talking about this new kind of public transportation that had just arrived in Montreal. And that was a hackney cab. And he had someone write a letter, because he couldn't write, and got the design for that cab.
And then where did their money come from?
Work.
So they get there, they get settled, they get a job, and he saves up enough and buys his cab.
Yep. I mean, nobody gave them anything. They worked their way up.
I mean, it's truly a success story, even leaving out all the political things that came with it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they continued to be involved in politics all their lives. They were involved. I mean, Thornton and Mrs. Blackburn, Thornton and Lucy Blackburn, when she was in freedom, of course, were not, I would say, outspoken leaders. They were not activists. What they were quiet supporters of freedom all their lives. So they gave money to black self-help ventures. They assisted in development of at least one make work project for fugitive slaves that was created in southwestern Ontario, and continued to receive fugitive slaves in their home to billet them as they arrived to help people get started and on their feet, like many of their neighbors did.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Carolyn Smarts Frost about her new book, I've Got a Home in Glory Land, A Lost Tale of the Underground Railroad. Smarts Frost will be at the Filson Historical Society on Thursday evening at 5:30. More information is available at filsonhistorical.org and at our website, wfpl.org. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to wfpl.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership, Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.